My brothers are helping by passing out those papers if you want those. People at the annex, I left them on that front table. You should have those if you want them. They're simply there to help you work through the information in a quick way because our class is somewhat condensed and we don't have a whole lot of time. Before I start class, I have two announcements to make. You know, we've already talked at one about a rebirth today, a reborn sister in Christ in Annalise. There's more happy news, and that is that Nate and Grace are still together. After 1 week married, they still love each other, which is really cool. I'm so excited about that. And they're back. They're here. They're back from their time away, and we're so glad they're here. And I'm not looking around the auditorium. I don't see him right now, but I thought that Travis and Sydney were going to be getting home tonight from Kentucky and the funeral there, but I saw him this morning. He was here. So if you see Travis, and I didn't see Sydney, but if Travis and Sydney are here, hug their necks and keep them in your prayers. That's a great loss to Travis, his mother, and they weren't necessarily expecting that. So, all right. Well, we're talking today about worship and our assemblies. In our series, Why Do You Call Me Lord? Why call me Lord if you're not going to treat me as Lord? That's the whole point of our title in this. So I want to first of all say that worship is pretty critical. I'm going to tell you that I think sometimes we have the idea maybe that worship is for us, and it's about us, so it needs to meet our needs. And I'm going to suggest to you that's not true, and that it falls in the realm of a lot of the authority matters that we've been looking at already. God not only demands worship, but he also directs how it is to be conducted. In Nehemiah chapter 12 and verse 45, the text reads, they performed the worship of their God and the service of purification together with the singers and the gatekeepers in accordance with the command of David and of his son Solomon. Not suggestions, not creation, but the command that they had from David and Solomon, who received, if you go back, we're not going to go into all those texts because they're piecemeal, they got their information from God himself. So God told David and told Solomon, here's what I want in worship. This is what we're to give to God. When it comes to worship, it is not about creativity, folks. It is about what does God want? What's he looking for from us in our worship? And so there are a couple of passages you have on your papers. In Psalm chapter 2 and verse 11, the text reads, worship the Lord with reverence. I'm going to really bear down on this. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. What an interesting idea. Rejoice with trembling. Now, there are two kinds of trembling. There's a trembling of anticipation and excitement. You sometimes see that in sports figures before they go out on the field or onto the court or into the arena, and they're pumped up and you can see it in them. They're just trembling with that, ready to go. That's not the word that's used here. There is that kind of excitement, trembling that's mentioned in the scriptures, but not here, not here. This is the word that's used of fear, and even used on one occasion of the, it's used of panic. The idea of being almost terrified of what you're going to do. Now, I'm going to tell you, I don't think, and I don't want to be misunderstood here, I don't think that it means that when we walk into an assembly of God's people, we're quaking, wondering, is he going to strike us dead? Or is he really angry at us right now? And should we be worried that if we do one thing wrong, he's going to be mad? I don't think that's a point. But I'll tell you what I do think is a point. When we're worshiping, we need to constantly be thinking, how's God viewing this? What is God thinking about this? Not just how am I feeling? How do I like it? Oh, this is not one of my favorite songs, or this is not my favorite topic, or I don't like this. Are we thinking in those terms, or are we thinking more in terms of how is God reacting to this? What does he want from us at this point? Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. So we can rejoice, but it's also with the idea that this is in the presence of God. We need to be very careful that we don't become worship consumers. The idea that this is about me and this is what I want and this is what I enjoy, and can we do more of this because I like this, or that's my favorite thing to do. It's not that at all, folks. This other passage, Psalm 115, verse 1, says, "Not to us, O Lord," and then it repeats it, "not to us, but to your name give glory." So worship involves us, but it's not about us. And I think if I could give you a help with this, I think worship is the difference in watching a movie or a play and in being an audience at a competition or sports event. There's a difference in those. When I'm watching a movie or a play, I'm simply looking at what is happening and I'm just enjoying the benefits of it. But when we go to a sport event, generally, there are exceptions, but generally, we're involved in it. We're there because we want to be there, and in all likelihood, we probably have a favorite team or person that we're rooting for and engaged with. It's an activity, but it's something that also activates our hearts. There's a difference. We're not that way in a movie theater. In a movie theater, it's about me and the screen. There are other people around me, and I may react based on what they do or what they think. But it's not about my necessarily being involved in what happens. The movie's already made. The play's taking place. It'll happen without me. But at a sporting event, I root for it. I'm involved. I want to see my team do better. I want to see my player succeed. I'm active in it. That's what worship is. Worship is active. It's something we're doing, and we're doing that so we can bring about a result, an end in all of this. So is it possible that spiritual sacrifices may not be acceptable to God? Notice I'm using the word spiritual sacrifices. Is it possible that we can sacrifice something to God and it be spiritual in nature and it not be acceptable to him? And I want to suggest that it is possible. I don't know if I put the text up. Nope, I didn't. So let me go back. The text for that I would look at is 1 Peter 2:5. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5, Peter says, "We are to offer up spiritual sacrifices," and then he adds this phrase, "acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Now, the fact that he says we're to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God implies what? That there are some spiritual sacrifices that are not acceptable to God. So worship depends on not just my actions, but my attitude. It's not just what I do, it's how I do it. It's the heart with which I do that. So in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 8, Matthew 15 verse 8, here's what Jesus says. "This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me." Their heart is far away from me. And then he says, as a result of that, "In vain
do they worship me? It's in vain. Now look, I didn't prepare you with this information before we started this morning, but I think it's important probably for us to pause and think about this. When our brothers were leading us in songs this morning, you sang them beautifully. Everybody was on key and everybody was singing the parts and everybody was staying together. But it's about more than that. It's not just the way it sounds. And you and I may sometimes say, I just love this song. I love the way it sounds. I love the way I feel when I'm singing this. Remember what Jesus says here. These people worship me with their lips. Sounds good. The words are all there. It's honorable words. But their heart is far from me. Far from me. So if we're singing, if we're praying, we can have the right words, but not have the right attitude. Part of authority is not just what we do, but it's how we do it. What motivates us to do the things that we do. And worship happens, true worship. Remember Jesus' conversation with the Samaritan woman when he said, those who worship God must worship him, how? In spirit and in truth. I will tell you, I think sometimes we can fall off either end. I think there are times when we may feel what worship is really about is truth. It's just getting the right information out. And spirit isn't really important. In fact, it's kind of dangerous. But the other end of that is just as dangerous. And I'm going to tell you something. You don't have to go far. Just get online and look at some of the churches that are worshiping online and watch the overt hyper-emotion of everybody there. I was watching a service not too long ago from a church that meets here in the Tampa area, curious about it, and I got online and watched, and I got to tell you this. I saw the typical things, the band on stage and the lights and everybody into that and the hands lifted in the air. But if you had turned the sound off completely and you didn't know what was there, you'd think you were at some kind of a concert, a secular concert. People jumping up and down, moving around. My point is not it's wrong to jump up and down or wrong to move or wrong to lift your hands. But when it becomes so overtly emotionally driven that you no longer are really involved in truth, are we worshiping God the way he has desired our worship? And the other end of that is, are you moved by anything? I mean, is there anything moves you to tears or to extreme joy? Because that's the spirit part of it that's also important. Both of those are critical in our walk with the Lord. Worship him in spirit and in truth. How does Matthew chapter 7 relate to this idea of our worship? In Matthew 7, if you go back there or just listen as I read it for you, in chapter 7, here's what Jesus says. Verses 21 through 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me, notice that first of all, it's many. Not a few. Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name cast out demons and in your name perform many miracles? Didn't we do that, Lord? And he says, I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. You who operate outside my authority, who do not do what I really wanted. In form, it looks good. Somebody might walk in this morning and have worshiped with us and said, that was an incredible worship period. Those people were so involved in their worship, and they were there. And God, I pray not, but God might look down and say, that was lawlessness. Their hearts weren't even in it. They were just reciting the words or saying the things they were supposed to say. Even that guy teaching the class, those are good words, but his heart wasn't in that. I pray that's not true for us. But it is about more than just what we do, but the attitude with which we do those things. Worship. It's the word proskuneo. That doesn't mean anything to you, but in Judges chapter 7, verse 15, that word is used, and it means to bow in worship. What are we talking about when we talk about this subject of authority, folks? We're talking about bowing before God. We're talking about giving him what he wants. It's not about me. It's not what I want. It is what you want, God. Everything we do should begin with that in mind. Not, would this be good for all of us? Is that something we want to do? But rather, first question, is that what God wants from us? God is in charge of worship. So in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 1, I read this statement about the Old Testament worship that says, even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary. Regulations of divine worship. Mentally underline that. That's really important. Because when you look at the Old Testament worship, where they worshiped, when they worshiped, who was to worship, how they were to worship, all, and what they were to do in that worship, all determined by God. Every aspect of that was given to them by God. No person said in the Old Testament worship, hey, I got an idea. Look, what if we sacrificed lambs? They're real innocent creatures, and they kind of would represent the innocence that we want to have, but our sin causes. Hey, that's a great idea. Let's follow that. That's a great symbol. Let's do that. Nobody did that. Nobody said, hey, let's pick the Levites. I like them. They're always dignified. There's not as many of them as there is of some of the other tribes, so they could be really useful here. Let's let the Levites be our priests. They didn't determine that. They didn't determine where they were to worship or how often or when or who was to be involved. God determined all of that. And I will suggest to you, God has determined that for the first century church and the church that follows the example of the first century church. He has determined what our worship should look like, what is involved in it, and why we do what we do, and when we do what we do. These things all come from God. Let's look at them quickly. Number one, they shared in the supper of the Lord. The Lord's Supper was never intended to be an individual event. Never. It was always intended to be a corporate or corporeal body, a body event. All the members participating and sharing together as they are able. That's what it was meant to be. In Acts chapter 20 and verse 7, you've got this statement about Paul going to Troas, and on the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to what? To what? Break bread. When they came together to break bread on the first day of the week. Actually, it's in the first person pronoun, plural, when we were gathered together to break bread. Luke, the writer, is involved in this. They did this when? They did this on the first day of the week. Now, I'm going to say something to you. I can still remember on one occasion Jeff Waltmeyer presiding at the Lord's table, and he used these words very carefully. He said, "We participate now in the supper of the Lord following the example of the first century disciples." You know, there is no command given that I know of that we are to do this on the first day of the week. There's no command I know of. But there is an example of that. And you may say, well, yeah, but I mean, one example doesn't mean that's what they did all the time. I mean, Ralph, if I saw you at breakfast at Chick-fil-A on a Tuesday morning, would I assume every Tuesday you're there or that you do that every morning just because I saw one example? Well, let me point out the impact of this example to you for just a moment. This example carries with it the weight of implication. There is an implication or an inference on our part that this was a time set aside for the participation in the supper of the Lord. It didn't just happen that he got there and it was Sunday and they said, oh, this just happens to be one of the days we do this. You could have been here Tuesday or Thursday because we do that then also. It says, they arrived in Troas within 5 days, verse 6, and there we stayed 7 days, and on the first day of the week. It is very clear from the text that Paul got there on Monday and waited 7 days because on the first day of the week, the disciples were going to break bread. On the first day of the week, when we gathered to break bread. And you may say, well, but I mean, that doesn't mean that that's the only time that he could have done that with them. I suggest it is because I happen to know from the text, verse 16, that Paul was in a hurry to get to Jerusalem. He wanted to be there for Pentecost. That was very important to him. And it is actually mentioned a couple of other times in the course of this journey that Paul was hastening to get to Jerusalem. So if he's in a hurry to get to Jerusalem, what would make him languish at Troas for 7 days? He wants to be there when the saints gather to break bread. So he's got to wait. They're not going to do it on Tuesday. He got there on Monday. They're not going to do it on Wednesday. Not going to do it on Thursday or Friday or Saturday. But on Sunday, they're going to break bread. And he wants to be there for that. So he waits, even though he's in a hurry. He's in such a hurry that when he wants to meet with the elders of Ephesus, he doesn't even go up to Ephesus. He has them come down to meet him at Miletus because he is in a hurry to get to Jerusalem. And those elders of Ephesus are 60 miles away by land. But he says, look, I'm going to Miletus. Come down and meet me. I'm getting to Jerusalem. I've got to get going. Meet me at Miletus. Yet here he is at Troas waiting 7 days. I draw a conclusion from that. That's the day the saints gathered to participate in the supper of the Lord. And that is why this church never has, and as long as people of our mentality, current leadership mentality are present, will never offer the Lord's Supper on Saturday night or Tuesday morning. Because that's not what the disciples did. Now, we might argue, well, so what's the big deal about the first day of the week? And in the final analysis, I don't have to know. I don't have to know the reasoning. God doesn't have to tell me why. There were times when I was a boy growing up, my mother would say, do this. And I'd say, why? And her answer was what? Because I said so. Period. Period. My dad didn't use that word. My dad just frowned. He would. And I knew. God doesn't have to explain his reasons for everything. But I think it's very clear this was the practice of the first century church. And that was the practice, by the way, of the second century church. And the third century church. They continued that practice of only participating in the supper of the Lord on the first day of the week for hundreds of years. Because they followed the example of the first century church. And the disciples used, clearly, unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. Why? That's what Jesus used. When he participated in the feast, that's what he used. So why would we do any differently? Do I have to have a significant reason for doing what the disciples did? I know this. If I do that, I'm going to do what my Lord did. I'm going to do what the first century disciples did. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and chapter 11, repeatedly, Paul talks about the bread which we break and the cup which we take. He never once in that concept talks about whatever food we eat. And I'm saying that because it may very well be that at some point somebody suggests, well, why don't we add some other things to the supper of the Lord? Or what if we don't like grape juice or the fruit of the vine? Can we just use something else? I would suggest that's not what the first century church did. That's not what they did. They offered unleavened bread and fruit of the vine. And some may argue that there's a reason for using those things. I don't know that we have to argue it. I could make the case, well, unleavened bread is without leaven, and leaven is often used as an symbol of sin. All that's valid. But there's also Jesus' statement that the gospel is like leaven that permeates the world. So that's a good thing. And I could argue, well, the grapes are there because you have to crush them in order to gain what you want from them, and Jesus had to be crushed in order to be our sacrifice. I could argue that, but there's no argument made that way in the scriptures. It might make a nice point for us, but it's not what the Bible says is the situation. So I want to do what the Lord wants me to do, and what the Lord wants me to do is what the first century church did, pure and simple. We have praying together. All those passages, by the way, talk about corporate prayer. That doesn't mean that's the only time we can pray. Far from it. We can pray individually, but there are times when the saints need to assemble to pray. Could we have an entire worship service and never pray? Sure we could. I'm going to suggest to you, that there are five things I'm going to mention, but there is no concept in the scriptures of the five acts of worship. You got to do all five of them or you haven't worshiped. I do think there are a couple of them that are restricted to the first day of the week, but we could have a service in which all we do is sing, or all we do is pray. And on the first day of the week, as long as we add the Lord's Supper and the giving by the saints, we've worshiped the Lord acceptably. It isn't check it off, we've done this, we're almost done, check off number five, good, we're finished, let's go home. It isn't that. They sang together. We know they sang together. They sang individually. Paul and Silas are singing in prison. But we know the saints sang together because it says they spoke to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Speak to one another. You know, that's a really cool concept that when we sing, we're singing to one another and speaking spiritual truths. We share the word. Acts 20, verse 7, when the disciples, when we had gathered to break bread, Paul spoke to them, preparing to depart on the morrow. It says he began talking to them. By the way, the word there that's used is the idea of what's delivering a lesson, not just Paul said, hey, let's talk for a little while about who we are and where we are. And it is a deliverance of a message from God. His message is sermonic. Letters. The letters were read aloud in the assemblies. Colossians 4, verse 16. And that is worship because it honors God and his word. And they gave of their financial resources. They did that on the first day of the week. He says, on the first day of the week. Look, do I have to know why on the first day of the week? Is it because that's when the banks are open? Or the banks will open Monday morning, so you collect the money on Sunday? I'll tell you why I think it is. It's because that's when the disciples gathered. They came together to break bread. It was a very appropriate time for them to also give of their means. So they gave on the first day of the week. They did that. And if I could have somebody give me some passage that indicates the disciples took up contributions at other times of the week, I would say, well, then that's not a binding or restrictive giving, but simply one of the many times we can give. But I'll tell you what, you won't find it. There's no passage I know of that says they collected money on other days of the week. There's none that I know of. Now, individually, we can do whatever we want with our money, but when it came to our corporate giving and the putting together of the money for the work of the church, it was done when? On the first day of the week. So let me give you three conclusions and we'll close. Number one, worship is to be participated in by all God's people. He instructs us to do this. He tells us, be involved. You should do this. This is what we do. When we pray together. When we sing together. Now, I don't think that means that if I'm not singing every phrase, I'm somehow violating God's will. But we're meant to all sing. We're all to participate. And we're all meant to listen to the word and respond to the word when it's offered. And we are all called upon as we have the wherewithal to give of our means, as we've been prospered. We're to do that cheerfully.